get on with the show. And as our pre-show advertising mentioned, that when you look at how the American military is structured right now and really within most people's living memory, a large standing army and a large active duty military, it really isn't the norm for this nation or even the design in this nation. But we also live in a world that has national security requirements, which a country like ours kind of has to lean into. And is there a way, when you reach a period of budgetary pressures, to maintain a strong military capability available and scalable if needed without a structure that becomes too much of a larger burden in order to maintain politically or financially? And is there a better way that we can organize and utilize our military reserves and our National Guard forces to kind of better be in line with how we see our economic and national security issues wrapped inside of our constitutional requirements today? And our guest for the full hour, and we're going to use as a touchstone and a stepping off point, is an article that recently came out, Going Back to the Future, Militia Model Could Cut U.S. Expenditures. You can find a link to that over at my homepage. It will be the former Chief of Staff of the Air Force, General Ron Fogelman, U.S. Air Force retired. General Fogelman, welcome to MidRats.
Well, thank you, Sal. It's good to be here. I look forward to our discussion this afternoon.
Yes, sir, and it's a great opportunity to be able to use an hour of your time to talk about a subject that you look at things that ripe for discussion. This is a topic that's ripe for discussion. And reading your article, there's a quote in there I was hoping you could flesh out for us, because I think it'll better define the term, because the term means a lot of different things to different people. But the quote that you have in there is, quote, "return to our historic roots as a militia nation," unquote. What does that mean in a 21st century concept?
Well, let me go back and put a little historical context on it, if I could. At the time that our constitutional forefathers were in the process of drafting the Constitution, they were reflecting on the experiences of the 16th and 17th century in Europe and to a certain extent here in the United States in the 1700s. And basically, one of the things that they decided that they did not want to burden the nation with was a large standing military force, because they had seen what national armies required of populaces in terms of taxation, imposed billeting, all of these things. So it was a very deliberate first article of the Constitution that said that, you know, we would raise and maintain an army, but we would be a militia nation. And so with that as a foundation, we have historically tried to keep the size. We did during the 1800s and during the early part of the 20th century, keep the size of the active standing military force as small as possible. And then in time of crisis, we would mobilize the militia, the reserve forces. We would do what we needed to in order to meet the challenge. So if you go back and you look at the major conflicts of the 1800s, and you, let's start with, say, the Mexican-American War in the 1830s, there's a case where you basically recruited militia forces to go off and fight that war. When it was over, we demobilized and went back to a very small standing military force. And you move forward to even the American Civil War, where on both sides, but particularly in the North, as we built the Union Army, we built it around a relatively small military force, standing military force. And at the end of the war, it was demobilized, and what was left of an active military force, particularly of the Army, was sent to the frontier, where it was pretty much dispersed and was out there to tame the West, if you will. The next big challenge that comes along is the Spanish-American War. And once again, it's a war that's fought primarily with volunteers and guardsmen, militia, and quite frankly, there were some failings that were discovered during the Spanish-American War with this concept. And it was after that that L.U. Root, when he was Secretary of the War, enacted and got put into place some modifications to the guard system, the reserve system, so that our forces would be more readily available and more combat ready when needed. And so when you at the end of that war, we demobilized again. World War I comes along. We mobilize, build up, fight the war. At the end of the war, we do demobilize, and we have a very small standing military force during the 1920s and 30s. Second World War comes along, we mobilize, and we end up with over 12.5 million men and women under arms during the Second World War. When the Second World War is over, for the first time in our history, we demobilize in the immediate aftermath of the war, but we almost immediately begin to restructure our military in a way that we had never done for a long period of time. And so by the early 1950s, with the establishment of the Warsaw Pact in Europe and opposing it NATO, and with this idea that you had the USSR sitting there in a position to overrun Europe within a very short period of time, we made a decision that we would put a large number of active duty people into Europe, and that we would support that large number of people with a rotation base that required us, for the first time in peacetime, to have a large standing military force. And so what happened then is from the early 1950s down until the end of the Cold War, what everybody has seen as the American model, that is a large combat-ready forward-deployed force, really is an aberration, but it has been seen by many people as the norm for the U.S. military construct. And so with the end of the Cold War, we actually had an opportunity to demobilize and to relook this large standing military force that we had maintained for 40 years, but we failed to do that. We missed an opportunity in the early 1990s to do that. Now, I have some theories. I was part of that. I was at that time the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Transportation Command, later the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. I was part of the deliberations that led to what I think was a missed opportunity to get ourselves back into more of the norm for the American military institution. So I'll stop there and see if you have any questions on that as we move forward.
Well, the first question I have is sort of related to that, but what I see, and when I read your article in the Defense News, was that the Marines and the Army are going to look at this and say to themselves, this is the Air Force and the Navy fitting the Army and the Marines out with cement boots so that the air-sea battle mafia will be dropping us over the side. How do you counter a response like that from the Army and the Marine Corps?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. This is the way it appears on the surface. However, and particularly, it would appear this way had we not had, at long last, at least some semblance of an articulation of a national security strategy going forward. And so as that started to come to fruition last fall, and we started to see, as a nation, you know, what were the fundamental principles going to be behind this strategy that was being put out there. And with it, we saw a shift to the focus to the Far East and to the types of forces that were most likely to be used there. So it isn't as though this is just an attack on ground forces. In fact, in that strategy and in the budget imperatives that came out of that, as you know, the Army had already decided that they were going to pull down their force structure. The Marines were going to basically pull down their force structure by 20,000. And so, in fact, both the Marines and the Army are very much in line with what I'm articulating here. As the Army pulls down its force structure, it is said that it's only going to reduce its reserve forces by about 8,000 troops. So what you're doing is transferring this combat capability that we've built up over the years into the reserve and guard in a way that hopefully will save us some money and allow us to recapitalize. The Marines say that they are going to maintain the size of the Marine Reserve as they pull down their active duty forces. And so I think both of these forces, when you look at the driving factors in the current strategic guidance, which is, you know, we're at the end of a decade of war. There's been a big change in the technological and geopolitical landscape. And we have this national security imperative that's tied to deficit reduction. When you start to do that and you see that there are changes in how the U.S. military will be used over the future, I think it's hard to argue that you cannot bring down some of the forces that we've had over the last 10 years. To include, the Air Force is going to continue to take force structure reductions, and while the Navy, I think, has taken most of their reductions, I think there will be some reductions there also. It's what you do with those reductions, I think, that's going to be the key, and it's how you balance the active force and your guard or reserve that's going to make the difference.
Yeah, you know, I really like when you mentioned before, you know, you're talking about, you know, many times history gives you an opportunity to make some fundamental changes going forward. And many times one of the worst things you can do is just keep going where the inertia had you going before. Even before the latest discussions in the broader sense, I know the Navy back, especially 07, 08, 09, was talking about some different concepts of how to structure the fleet, to, you know, trying to look forward and what we need to have and the capabilities we need to have to give us most flexibility. But I think we're at that another inflection point where there's some larger themes even beyond the budget going on, because it goes back to, you know, the founding of this country, and there's something rather unique about this nation from a geography and a political point of view that really nobody else has besides maybe the Canadians. That's where we're relatively isolated, even in the speed of light communications that we have and intercontinental weapons. We still have time and distance in our favor. We have relatively secure borders. And with World War II and the Cold War well behind us, even though we act like there's still an echo there, we also look at what in some people's minds is still modernizing, but it's a quarter century old. That's Goldwater Nichols. And we really do have the opportunity here, and I think the budgetary pressures may be the catalyst to get us to go there. But unlike the last time where you were in that discussion, do you see the intellectual and leadership critical mass to stop doing the easy thing, which is going with inertia or just doing even haircuts, but really restructuring to best utilize what forces and money we have left to meet the challenge? There's going to be that critical mass of leadership that's going to be able to push this through.
Yeah, I first of all, I'm encouraged by some of what I see. some of the articulation that I see coming out of not only the Secretary of Defense, but members of the Joint Chiefs and out of the administration. But I think the jury's out on this because this is an issue that unfortunately I think is going to get politicized somewhat. And so from my perspective, the people who blindly say we cannot make any cuts, we cannot change anything, we have got to maintain our existing military force, they are arguing from a position that is as harmful in the long run to the security of this nation as the people who want to cut through sequestration or these kinds of things. And so I'm still seeing arguments from the do-nothing crowd, if you will. And I think the do-nothing crowd, and that's really what has, over time, caused us to be ill-prepared for certain contingencies and at the same time to waste tens of billions of dollars on the wrong kind of force structure, the wrong kind of equipment. Let me go back and sort of talk a little bit about my experience, or the experience of the early 1990s. In my view, I think that President Bush the Elder understood this overall U.S. military manpower in a historical perspective in a way that nobody since has really understood it. And I say that because during his administration, when he was working in a bipartisan manner, the head of the Senate Armed Services Committee in that time was Sam Nunn. He had started, he put a blueprint out there that had started to draw down our overseas forces to bring them back to the States and actually begin a demobilization process. I remember in the summer of 1990, I was sent out to Korea to be the deputy commander. And my boss, an Army four-star, when I got there and got settled in, at that time, we had about 40,000 troops in Korea, and he told me that that his task, our task, was to determine how we were going to take that number from 40,000 down to 16,000 in a period of about 18 months. But this was the direction that was coming out of the Bush administration. We were going to start down that path. And that was going on all around the globe, if you will. But, of course, President Bush was not reelected. President Clinton came in, and as he was coming in, there was a congressional direction that now that the Cold War was behind us, that we would do within the Department of Defense a bottom-up review. And this occurred in the spring of 1993. And the thing that happened during that bottom-up review, Les Aspin had just come over to be Secretary of Defense. His full staff wasn't in place. And by and large, the military took control of the bottom-up review. And as a result of that, there were a couple of assumptions made that basically locked us in to the kind of military structure we would have throughout the 1990s. And one of the assumptions was that there would be a base force. We would get no smaller than thus and such. The Army would have so many divisions, the Air Force so many wings, the Navy would have so many capital ships and so many carrier task forces. And there was a line that says, we won't go below that. So that that was the real peace dividend, if you will, that was going to occur. But the second assumption that was made was one that had just cost us dearly during the 1990s and has only recently been repudiated. And that is this idea that we had to be able to fight two major regional contingencies nearly simultaneously. What that did is it forced us to maintain force structure during the 1990s that we never used, and when it came time, when we were challenged a 911, it turned out to be the wrong kind of force structure. So we had to set out and rebuild the kind of military we needed to respond to the challenges of the last decade. Whereas if we would have made a fundamental change in the way we were using manpower, this idea of fighting two major regional contingencies simultaneously was nothing new. You know, during World War II, this nation fought two major regional contingencies. When we first started out, before we were fully mobilized, we actually made a deliberate strategic decision that said we would fight in Europe first, and we would delay in the Pacific until we got strong enough or we defeated Hitler and we moved then to the Pacific. But as it turned out, as this nation got mobilized, we were able to fight in both areas. So this idea that we had to be able to fight two places nearly simultaneously just drove up the number of divisions and air wings and all these things that you needed, rather than take the assumption that says you can bring this down, be prepared for that major regional contingency, have a holding force, which, by the way, is probably going to end up being air and naval, that allows you to hold the situation until you are then able to mobilize and adjust the second thing. That was a lot of force structure that cost us a lot of money that could have gone other places during the 1990s. I'll stop there and let you address that.
Well, one of the concerns, General, that I have is that we always seem to be prepared, as you're well aware, to fight the last war, or what we perceive to have been the last war. I know at the start of World War II, my dad was riding horses around California and Arizona with horse cavalry because they were a legacy of some previous iteration of cavalry forces. In your view of how we make this future with the constitutional militia, what does the force structure look like? Well, how do we make sure that we're ready for the next war, and what things should we be aware of as we look at that?
Well, I think that we need to, for the land forces, we need to size those active duty forces for what we think is, and this is very difficult to come up with, but what is the most logical scenario that you may have to fight, and on what timeline are you going to have to do that? We've already heard several of our senior leaders, and hopefully they reflect the general judgment in Washington, that we are not about to anytime soon probably fight a war in Asia where we're going to put a lot of boots on the ground. Now, I must tell you that the exception to that could well be Korea, where just because of the instability of the regime, although it seems the transition seems to be going well, we could find ourselves very quickly involved in a war there. But again, how we choose to conduct that war tells us a lot about the kind of force structure we need. So what I'm looking at is a lot of good studies have been done over the last 5 or 6 years that look at things like how can you keep a guard or reserve force ready, and how can you get to it? And this whole issue of how do you depend on a guard and reserve force without breaking it by having it mobilized too much. And, of course, they've gone to this model that says, well, what we really want is a 5-to-1 dwell time. That's what the ground forces basically say that they want. And at the same time, in the air, we haven't subscribed to the 5-to-1 in years, but we've done it basically in terms of numbers of days deployed versus number of days and dwell time. It's only when you start to do that that you can begin to see where you can have some significant manpower savings. And this is tied to what I think has been a tremendously successful program in the United States military, and that has been the all-volunteer force. Now, if you think about the history of the all-volunteer force, in the late 1960s, as we were coming out of Vietnam, President Nixon basically asked his Secretary of Defense to look at a way that we could do away with the draft, that, you know, it had become very unpopular. It was seen as being unequal to various segments of society. And so the Secretary at that time turned to a previous Secretary of Defense, Secretary Gates, the one who just stood down, but that secretary then came up with this idea of an all-volunteer force. And we eliminated the draft. It led to a much more professional force because, one, everybody wanted to be there. Two, it was a much more efficient and effective force because at the time we were doing this in the mid-1970s, and as we then continue down through the 70s and 80s and 90s, all branches of our service got more technical. So the utility of a two-year draftee or a three-year draftee really dropped. And it was, you saw a real change in trying to recruit to keep somebody in the military for 2 or 3 years to... You wanted to recruit, and then you wanted to retain people as long as you could once you got them trained, because training was so expensive and so specialized. Now, there were places where that wasn't necessarily true in some of the combat arms, et cetera. But in the main, even in the combat arms, it has become much more technical, and the training is so valuable that you cannot afford to be turning these people over. So as the all-volunteer force then over time grew, in order to keep these people in the military, you had to pay them a competitive wage. And that has been done. And then in the first sustained period of combat involving an all-volunteer force, once all the vestiges of the draftees were gone, the last 10 years... What we have seen is that the all-volunteer force, in its present size and composition, that is, the number of people in the all-volunteer force who are in active duty versus those in the reserve and guard, has literally gotten to the point where I think it is unaffordable, as do others. And so, now these troops deserve the pay and the benefits they get for what they have done. But it is just simply unaffordable when up to 50% of the DOD budget is now focused on just paying for the troops. And you project that out over a number of years, and we just have an unsustainable situation. So we're not about to go back to a draft, which is, as I said, would not be very effective and very efficient. And so what we've got to do is we've got to change the mix. And at the same time, we will see, as we have already seen indications in the 2013 budget, some of the pay and benefit models that were based on the old conscript force will end up being changed also. So to me, this is a major factor in this whole idea of what are we really looking at? Why are we talking about trying to put more of this capability in the Guard and Reserve? And remember that as you draw down this active force, that becomes the source of your trained personnel that go into these Guard and Reserve units. And we can talk some more about education and other things, but I'll stop there.
Yeah, that's it. Back in late 2009, I was over at a Milblog conference, and they had a up in D.C., and they had a panel there that was talking about pay and benefits of the military. And I think that the ground has shifted a little bit, but I brought up a question mostly focused on retirement benefits, because when you look at our closest peers, the Europeans, their retirement systems are very different than ours, and as far as when you start getting paid. And at that point, nobody really wanted to go there, but now they're starting to talk about it. And speaking of the Germans, earlier this month, I read over on the English version of Spiegel that the Germans have finally gotten rid of conscription. They're going to the full all-volunteer military. And as you were discussing before, you know, back in the 70s, when we moved in the post-Vietnam era towards a professional force, part of, from what I've read, part of the intellectual mix of doing that was to have more forces in the reserves in the National Guard. So if the National Command Authority decided that it wanted to commit its military to a long-term conflict, that they would have to tap into those forces, and as a result, you would give a whole national buy-in. And I think we've seen in the last 10 years a couple of things. The reserves and the National Guard have substantial combat experience on the field, which I think invalidated one concept, which was if you call up the National Guard and reserves, that would make people more interested in the war going on. I never saw that. But what I think it also did, which ties into your concept, is there was always a little bit of looking down on the reserves or looking down on the National Guard as not quite being as good of a force per person. And there's a lot of anecdotal stories people will tell. But when you look especially how the Marine Corps Reserve was integrated in 2003 during the invasion of Iraq, the unquestionable Air National Guard and Air Reserves, their performance, and even our National Ground Combat units that have performed in Iraq and Afghanistan, I think it's also invalidated that concept that you can't have a reserve or National Guard force that, given proper preliminary training, a mobilization plan, and it does give you a good scalability to be able to give you some confidence that those forces are going to be able to do what you want them to do going forward. Is that what you have seen as well?
Yes, I mean, you're absolutely right on target. First of all, to kind of go back to the beginning of your discussion there about there are some people who refer to it as the Abrams Doctrine, that, you know, in the early 1970s there, when all this was coming about, General Abrams, who had experienced this sort of disconnect between the military force and the American public, really embraced the total force concept, because he thought that it would, if you could build the force in such a way that the national command authorities could no longer engage in major conflict without calling up the Guard and Reserve, you would guarantee that there would be a tie to the American public, since these people live and operate day in and day out in the communities. There's been various views on this, but I think there was some element of truth in that it led to the way, and this is relevant to the last part of your discussion, it led to the way missions and responsibilities were assigned to guard units and to active duty units. And, of course, I think there was a real bias against the Guard and Reserves during the 1980s, and you saw this manifest itself during the first Gulf War, when there was no land unit, Guard or Reserve unit, that made it into combat. And if you were somebody who was looking at it from the Guard and Reserve perspective, they said that was because the active duty didn't want it to happen. If you were looking at it from the active duty perspective, they said it's because this is this whole idea that guardsmen and reservists can be combat ready within a short period of time is a false concept. But as a result of what has happened during the last 10 years, I think this is pretty much behind us, both for the active duty guys and the guardsmen and the reservists. And so now the challenge is to really figure out that balance. You know, is it this 5-to-1 dwell time? Do you go to a tiered readiness concept for land forces, which is something in the Air Forces we've never thought was the right way to go. But there are some good minds now thinking about this on both sides of the equation. And here's where I think there's a personal dimension that's going to come into this that will be different than we've seen in a long time. And that dimension is this. As a result of the performance of the Guard and the Reserve folks during the last 10 years, where they have actually deployed forward and stood shoulder to shoulder with their active duty counterparts at all levels, company grade officers, field grade, flag grade, I think that there is a new respect and appreciation both ways for what these forces have done. And so you're going to have a whole new generation of, for instance, of adjutant generals come up in the States that served with people who are going to be key decision makers in the active force. And these adjutant generals are going to have credibility with these active duty people because they were there. And being able to say you were there is going to be important in the next 10 to 15 years as we look back on this bonding that went on. Even though I think in the next 10 to 15 years, the nature of our security requirements is going to be different than what it was, the ability to develop and fulfill the capabilities needed will be based on the experiences of the people who fought together over the past 10 years and are fighting together today.
One of the hesitant reservists who spent 21 years or so in the reserves and got called up for Desert Storm and for later on for Kosovo. One of the issues facing reservists is being prepared to do the job. One of my questions for you, if we're going to rely on heavily on the National Guard, Reserve, Air National Guard, what training structure do you envision? Of course, maybe an unfair question, but what training structure do you envision to keep them fairly current with the modern equipment and the capabilities, the teamwork, all that stuff that needs to be part of our modern battlefield?
Well, I think this is a this is a question that kind of has probably a bifurcated answer in the sense that I think over the years, since the total force policy went into effect, up until very recently, the Air Force, and not just because I'm a guy who wore the uniform, but I think the Air Force did total force better than generally the other services. I'm not that familiar, although clearly the Marine Reserve Forces did very well. The Air Force did it by virtue of making sure that the reserve and guard units were operating the same equipment with the same employment concepts and the same readiness requirements that your active duty folks had. Now you say, how can they do that? Well, the first thing is a large source for the pilots the navigators, the technicians, the maintenance people, everybody in the Guard and Reserve units has always been people separating from the active force. So you're getting a highly trained individual to start with. And then what you try to do is on those required drill periods that you have throughout the year, you try to keep people generally at a certain level of readiness. And then if you need them, if you need to mobilize them or you ask them to volunteer, it requires a relatively short period of time for specialized top-off training that may be required. And so that served us well across our fighter forces, our airlift, our tanker, in many areas. Now, there were areas where we simply didn't have guardsmen and reservists in the Air Force, and we've expanded the envelope to kind of to make sure that we are using them in greater numbers of places. I think to a certain extent, the same thing is possible with ground forces, but it's definitely a different challenge. The nature of peacetime training versus full-time training is very different. But if you make the assumption that you're going to start out with a fairly well-trained cadre, they can, on their regular drill periods, focus on the basics, and then you have in your war plan sufficient time so that when you begin to ask these units to either volunteer or you mobilize them, to do the more high intense training, that I think that they'll show that they can do that. And I certainly think that that's proven to be true over the last 5 or 6 years as we've seen what's happened in both Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't have all the answers, but I'll tell you what, I think we have more good people truly searching for those answers today than we've ever had in the past. And I just hope that these people can prevail and that we will continue to take this to the maximum extent that we can and not pull up shy. The primary reason is, again, back to cost. The cost per manpower slot in these days, I used to be a programmer in the Air Force, so somebody would say, hey, Ron, tell me what it would cost to put 10,000 people into this kind of a unit. And we had factors. And in those days, an enlisted troop cost about $40,000, an officer was about $50,000. And so you figured out what the ratio was, you multiplied, 10,000 times whatever the number was that you wanted, you multiplied 40,000 times whatever number you wanted of enlisted troops, and you had an answer. Now, that was 30 years ago. Today, those same numbers, when we start to look at it, are approaching $110,000 a copy for an enlisted troop and $125,000 a copy for an officer. Active duty, full-time slot. So if you want to figure out how much money you can save, take 80,000 Army troops, multiply it times 110,000, and then take some number out of that, and you'll be able to see that you can save big dollars in the personnel accounts very quickly that you can either redirect into modernization or readiness accounts.
I think that's one of the best arguments out there when you look at this, if you try to put a little bit of a business hat on it, and that's recapturing investment. There's a tremendous investment to create a pilot. There's a tremendous investment to create somebody that can be your final, collateral duty inspector, your safe for flight, or a chief engineer on a ship. And when these people leave active duty, for whatever reason they do, if they never have a reserve affiliation to go to, you lose a lot. Good friend of mine, Air National Guard guy, he can't fly anymore. But you know, he left Air National Guard as a colonel. He flew, I'll tell you how old he is, he flew F-104s, then F-15s, then F-16s. And he was exactly what you were talking about. He spent a little bit of time on active duty, but his skill set was captured and maintained at a relatively cost-effective point if it was ever needed. And I think the Air Force, you're right, they do a very, very good job of that. As a matter of fact, I know some naval aviators who are now wearing Air Force blue because the Navy has made a decision that it does not want to capitalize its reserves the way others do, so they are flying for the Air National Guard. There are areas that you can recapture that cost, but in order to do that, I think you have to have a strategy and a game plan in order to hook those onto, in order to make those changes. And I think, you know, getting back to the article you wrote and some other things are being written about it, there is a way to do that, but there has to be an ongoing conversation. Besides yourself, are there some other writers, defense intellectuals out there that are trying to get their hands around this concept of not only cost recapture, but getting us an affordable military, yet one that's reasonably scalable in case future throws us a different deck of cards in a few years?
Yeah, I think there are people out there. One of them that I can think about is James Carafano. He's, you know, he's a former Army officer who's done some very thoughtful writing over the last 6 or 7 years on the future of the reserves and the National Guard. Seems to know the history very well, and recognizes the potential. I think there have been a couple of studies that have been very well done. Arnold Panaro did a study a few years ago looking at this whole idea of the cost of military manpower and what are some of the alternatives. The services themselves have had studies done of I think, different qualities, if you will. The Air Force Reserve put out a white paper last year talking, it was the title of it was Total Force Policy 21, and then they put out a part two to it where they got a little more explicit about dwell time and cost and savings. So there are, you know, there are lots of studies going on. There's lots of opportunity for people to push this this forward and look for ways. And this, I think, is a secret. You've got to take off the blinders on how you've done things in the past, and you've got to think about how to do things more effectively in the future. I mean, you've got to break some paradigms, and you've got to look at the kind of equipment you're operating. Is it best operated in the Guard or Reserve or in the active force? What's the real balance that's absolutely required? You know, you don't want to run. You don't want to pull your active force down to the point where you run it into the ground. On the other hand, there are models, I think, where you ought to be able to talk about and determine what are sustainable participation levels. And these things are all there. I think it just takes a commitment. You know, I talked about the militia nation concept and how after each of our major conflicts, we always seem to demobilize. And interestingly enough, the demobilization process generally was driven by some congressional review of how we were going to use our manpower going forward from that particular conflict. And I just haven't seen that kind of a discussion coming out of the people on the Hill. And it would be, I think, really useful if we could get somebody who became a real advocate for a serious look at this from a national perspective.
One of the people in our chat room has raised a really interesting point, which I think you'll appreciate as a former Transcom guy, which is if we have a large reserve force, follow-on reserve force here in this country, what is that going to do to our need for airlift and sea lift assets to get them where they need to be should the need ever arise?
Keep in mind that the sea lift and the airlift force that we have today was sized to be able to respond to two nearly simultaneous major regional conflicts. And what I have seen of the 2013 budget is very little reduction in that capability. There are some heavy C-5As, I think, that are programmed to be retired, but you still have a strategic airlift force of 275-plus airplanes, something like that. And there have been great strides made at Transcom to make better use of the Civil Reserve air fleet and an equivalent in the naval forces. And so I don't think a limiting factor is going to be lift. It's going to be a function of what do you build into the timeline in terms of response time, et cetera, and who says you have to be there the day after tomorrow. And so I think that a CONUS-based force that is prioritized in terms of how they're moved forward can be handled with a well-thought-out transportation mobilization plan.
And I think that whole concept that you mentioned there, you know, CONUS-based with global reach, and if you look at the strategic airlift and sea lift requirements that would take, it really plays in well, I think, with more of a militia nation concept. Because like you said, who says you have to be there the day after tomorrow? You should be able to have at least a little bit of warning or accept that risk to be able to have your mobilization time. But it's very expensive to have your strategic airlift and sea lift on active duty. But if you have the materiel, i.e. the ships and the aircraft that are already purchased and are being used on a part-time basis, for lack of a better phrase, you really have an incredible